This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
You know, interesting having the conversation last block with Elliot Friedman about who's playing the best hockey in the NHL right now, today, Monday, March 25th. And it really comes down to two teams, although I might want to throw Carolina into that mix as well. But generally, it comes down to two teams, the Colorado Avalanche, who 2 years ago won the Stanley Cup, and the Nashville Predators. Point streak, 17 games. Amazing performances at all positions. Their lead sniper is also, checks notes, fighting and then scoring a game-winning 1-0 goal against the Detroit Red Wings on Saturday. Don't sleep on your Preds, fans. This is a really good team that I'm guessing nobody really wants to face off in the opening round, including those same Avalanche that I just mentioned a couple of seconds ago. Robbie Stanley is the co-host of Robbie and Rex Road on 102.5 The Game in Nashville, also a correspondent for the Nashville Predators at NHL.com. Robbie, how are you today?
Yep, I'm doing great, brother. How are you?
I'm doing well. Back-to-back shutouts will put a smile on everybody's face. I guess right now the only question around the Nashville Predators is a pretty bad one, and it goes like this. So, Robbie, are things great or really great around the Nashville Predators?
Right now they're really great, and I will say it's gone from a conversation of, man, what are they going to do at the deadline and how many pieces are they going to sell off to they haven't lost
right?
a game in regulation since they got beaten 9-2 over a month ago by the Dallas Stars. And it's been a lot of fun to watch. This run seemingly came out of nowhere, and they're playing really good hockey at all different levels right now. And like you said, I mean, Forsberg started chucking them the other night. I'm not sure that's exactly what Andrew Burnett and company wanted to see in terms of their leading scorer throwing the knuckles out there, but responds with a goal later in the game.
Yeah.
The crowd's loving it. A lot of fun out there.
You know, I thought his comments afterwards as well were hilarious. I mean, Philip Forsberg is low-key one of the funniest guys in the league, where he said something along the lines of, you know, at first I was doing pretty good, and then I wasn't. All of a sudden, Moritz Seider started with the lefts. And good on Philip Forsberg for having a sense of humor about it. But the thing about Forsberg is, I mean, first of all, when you look at the skill set that he possesses, like, he's among any of the elites in the NHL. He is, you know, on an absolute different level. But the thing that's always impressed me about Forsberg is just how, over the years, I mean, we always hear, oh, goal scorers are streaky, and I get that, all goal scorers are streaky, but there's an element of consistency that Forsberg has that few others do. When you see Philip Forsberg, you see him play, you see him practice, what goes through your mind, Robbie?
Well, I totally agree about the skill part of it. He's as skilled as most players, most of your elite players that you want to talk about in the league. But I think when he's really going, he leans into the power forward game. And I think early in his career, that's not something he was really good at. I mean, the skill has always been there. The shot's always been there. But when he really starts dominating and really wearing on teams, using his size, using his body, getting to the front of the net, that's when I think he's really effective. And Jeff, his hands are quick enough around the net where he can make plays in really tight areas. And I think that's why, two out of the last 3 years, you've really seen him buy into that. He was hurt last year for basically the second half of the year. But he's gonna hit 40 goals again. He may get to 45 somewhere in that neighborhood. And he's now exactly the player that I think Predators fans have envisioned him being for a long time now.
You know, there seems to be, and you've already indicated what it was, a real one-game demarcation point where everything changed, where all the success just sort of hinged. And that's a 9-2 loss at the hands of the Dallas Stars. Since that loss, you know, UC Saros is 11-0-2, save percentage of .936. We all know about, you know, the point streak, and we also all know about the canceled trip to the Sphere in Vegas to see U2. I was going to say, if Andrew Burnett ends up winning Coach of the Year this year, you know there better be a line or two in his acceptance speech about canceling the trip to go see U2. Or maybe the Nashville Predators ownership can pull some money off the tree in the backyard and hire U2 for a private party for everybody. But that's for another conversation. Can you take us back to that, like, to maybe the moment after, or the hours after, or the day after that loss to the Dallas Stars, 9-2 on February the 15th?
Well, I can tell you this. I've watched hundreds upon hundreds of Nashville Predators games. I've been around since they came here in 1998. That was the worst game I've ever seen them play. The first period, they were down 4-0 in that game, and it legitimately could have been 8-0 after the first period. And I know people say that sometimes, but legitimately. I mean, it could have been 8 or 9-0 mm-hmm. after the first period. And I think as much as the U2 concert and all that's gotten the headlines, I think more than anything, it was just pure embarrassment. Like the look on some of their faces, Ryan O'Reilly, Ryan McDonagh, guys who have done a whole lot of winning in this league, the look on their faces, the comments they made after the game, it was just sheer embarrassment. And I think after that, Roman Josi, Ryan McDonagh, Philip Forsberg, your leadership group said enough's enough. Like this is going to go one of two ways. Either we're about to totally fold into the sand here, or you can respond and do something about it. And I think to their credit, they have responded about as well as you can. Nobody could have imagined a 17-game point streak. But I think the embarrassment for that game was finally the tipping point of, if you don't buy into the way that the coach is asking you to play and you don't bring effort, you're nowhere near talented enough to coast by on talent alone. I think that message finally sunk in after that.
I'm glad you couched that the way that you did. I think that phrasing is really important because, I mean, listen, you've been there, as you mentioned, from day one. One of the things that I've been thinking about is how would other Nashville Predators teams have reacted to that same situation that this team went through on February the 15th in that game against the Dallas Stars, and then the decision made by the coach afterwards. And I think it's safe to say, and I'll be curious your thoughts on this one, I can think of a number of Nashville Predators teams that, to give it a soft landing, wouldn't have reacted the same way. Agree or disagree?
100% agree. And look, I'll just go ahead and say it. I mean, Barry Trotz came in, and I think it was pretty clear. He did about everything you could do to get Ryan Johansson and Matt Duchene out of the locker room. Like, it's clear that's what he wanted to do. And the production was a part of it. The money was a part of it. But, I mean, he made no bones about it. I mean, Barry Trotz has said multiple times, you don't come to Nashville to retire. You come to Nashville to win. I mean, that's a direct shot at Matt Duchene. And, he can kind of dance around it. Yeah. But that's what it is. And I think he needed a leadership change, and that's what he was going for with O'Reilly. He loves Ryan McDonagh, and he wanted to kind of shake up the culture mm-hmm. and the room. And I think really the Predators, especially from about 2019 until last season, had the same thing happen to them in that Dallas game, they would have folded. And this team, I think, is different. And I think that starts with guys like O'Reilly and McDonagh and Josi and kind of that new veteran foundation. I throw Gus Nyquist in there too, who has been outstanding. Like, those guys, I think, have really been everything Barry Trotz has been looking for.
Who have been some of the bigger surprises for you? Like, I'm a big Colton Sissons guy. I think he's played really well this season. On sort of like, not, you know, when we talk about Nashville, we talk about Josi and we talk about Saros and we talk about Forsberg. But like, who are some of the lower key guys you're seeing contributions from?
Well, right now, Luke Evangelista, who is really basically the one young forward that they have right now at 22 years old.
Yeah.
He's really coming to his own. He's playing really well. It feels like he's really grasped what they're trying to do out there from a system standpoint, and he's playing well. Jeremy Lozon has been outstanding all year. He's been injured. He might come back tomorrow night when they play the Vegas Golden Knights in a huge game. He's been fantastic, mostly alongside Alex Carrier. You know, Ryan McDonagh, everybody knows about Ryan McDonagh, but with Roman Josi on the team, he kind of goes under the radar a little bit with what he's done. I'll tell you what, Mark Jankowski, who spent most of this season with Milwaukee in the American Hockey League, he's come in, and ever since he's come into the lineup, I mean, they've been on this tear. And look, it's not a direct result of Mark Jankowski, but he came in, and I think really solidified on a line with Tommy Novak and Evangelista, and they kind of switched some lines around since then, since Anthony Beauvillier and Jason Zucker have entered the mix. But that he was a really, I think, steadying presence for those two. And Jankowski joined Novak and Evangelista, and as soon as he did, the secondary scoring with Novak and Evangelista started to pick up rapidly. So he's kind of been in an under-the-radar guy that I think has really helped the forward group.
So what is it? Here's the question then, because I don't think this is fool's gold. Like, this team is good. So what does this do then to Barry Trotz and the idea of rebuilding this? entire program, because you're right. Like, going into, you know, wondering about trade deadline all season long, it's like, okay, is this the year they finally move Saros? We all thought he was going to LA last year. Is this the year they pull the trigger? What happens to all these other players on the roster? What's, you know, what's the rebuild going to look like? We all know how, you know, frisky Barry Trotz was at the draft last year, specifically trying to move up, getting that San Jose pick at four, maybe grabbing Will Smith. Like, Barry Trotz is someone that wants to move aggressively here. But given how the team has played and all the personnel involved, what does this do to the idea of a rebuild?
Well, I think it's a great question, and I think it has to influence it to some degree, right? I mean, you know, there's kind of two different timelines. There's the timeline of everybody thinking about the Predators and the rebuilding side of things heading into the season. They, you know, Cody Glass, Philip Tomasino, Juuso Parsonen, Luke Evangelista. They had a ton of young guys. And a lot of those guys either aren't here right now or are down in Milwaukee or out of the lineup. And so they've gone from a young team to begin in the year to a veteran-laden team. I mean, you look at their roster right now, most of them are 27, 28, 29, 30, kind of right there in that mix. So they've changed up kind of the age of their roster. And I think the other thing is, like, in the back of your mind, you're still wanting to be able to compete for a cup with Philip Forsberg still in his prime, with Roman Josi still in his prime. And those guys don't have that many years left in his prime, especially when you're talking about Josi, who's 33 at the moment. So I think in the back of your mind, you're trying to kind of accomplish that thing, those two things at the same time. And Jeff, that leads to the obvious question of the Saros part of this too, which is going to come up again in the summer until he signs a contract extension or they decide to trade him. There's still the Askarov thing in the background. Which goalie are you going with? So, you know, if they go on a run here to close out the regular season and make things really interesting in the playoffs, I think that probably does influence the way that Barry Trotz tries to build out this team the next couple of years.
What goes through your mind when you hear goofballs like me and Friedman say Roman Josi should get Hart Trophy consideration?
Well, I think for sure that I would consider it. Now, you know, McKinnon's having a great year. I mean, McDavid's always there. We know the usual suspects. But basically, since the turn of the calendar year in 2024, and certainly on this 17-game run, he's playing the best hockey I've ever seen him play. And that's saying something, because I've seen him play some really good hockey over the stretch of his career. But he is dragging this team at times along with him. And look, they've had a lot of guys play really well. They've had the puck for the majority of these games. But the zone that he's in offensively right now is something to behold. And I think the Andrew Brunette system, you know, for years, Josi was basically the offensive system for the Predators. He would carry the puck up the ice. He would establish the offense. He'd go behind the net. He was always having the puck. And Josi kind of transitioning to getting the puck to the forwards as quickly as he can and then filling in the lanes behind that. He's finally, I think, figured that out, and he is just absolutely thriving with that in Andrew Brunette's system right now. So I don't hate that at all with Roman Josi getting in the Hart Trophy conversation.
So let me close with this one on you then, because and I'm sure you've thought about this and had conversations about this before as well. Right now, if the playoffs started today, Nashville would be facing off against Colorado.
Yep.
Arguably the two best teams right now in the NHL, Nashville and Colorado. Sign me up for seven of that. If Nashville could choose who they faced in the first round, and who knows who that could be, or that could be Vancouver, that could be Colorado, that could be Dallas, it could be any sort of combination here. If there was one team that you would look at and you would say, you know what, Andrew Brunette's version of this year's Preds and the way that they play match up really well against Colorado, Dallas, Vancouver, who would the Predators pick?
You know, I've waffled back and forth on this between Dallas and Winnipeg because I think it's close. But I think I would say Dallas. And I know some people would say, well, you're insane. They got beat 9-2 by Dallas. I get it. That game was terrible, and they would have gotten beat by anybody in the league with the way they played in that game. They've also gone to Dallas twice this year with their backup goaltender, won both of those games. They had another game against Dallas at home where they were winning the entire game and then gave up two goals in the last 13 seconds of the game to lose in regulation. So for the most part, other than the absolute drubbing that they took 9-2, they have matched up very well with Dallas this year. So I think that would be my answer, although I've waffled back and forth between them and Winnipeg.
I get it. It's one of those seasons, right? You have seven teams in the NHL right now, all separated by 1 point for top spot for the President's Trophy. If there's any season, Robbie, where you're allowed to waffle, it's this one, hands down. Thanks so much for stopping by, sharing your expertise. You're there for all of it. Thanks for sharing all of it here with us today. Much appreciated, Robbie. You be well.
Well, Jeff, it's a pleasure as always. You as well.
Robbie Stanley is the co-host of Robbie and Rexroad on 102.5 The Game in Nashville, NHL.com correspondent for the Nashville Predators. And that was like that for a 1-0 game. That was a really good one on Saturday afternoon between Detroit and the Nashville Predators, highlighted by a fight. I believe that is Philip Forsberg's third career fight in the NHL against Moritz Seider. And as Forsberg said in what might have been the line of the weekend, paraphrasing, I thought I did pretty good to start until I didn't do very well. And that was the end of the fight. Who knew Moritz Seider was a lefty? None of us, because that was his first career NHL fight. Nonetheless, thanks to Robbie for stopping by. Much appreciated. Do not sleep on the Preds. This is a very good team. Next in action, by the way, on Tuesday, I believe, against Vegas. I think Vegas has the back-to-back. Let me double-check that for you right now. Yes, it is tomorrow. They'll face off against the Nashville Predators at home. So there you go. Keep your eyes on the Preds. Time now for a line change presented by Sports Interaction, your homegrown sports book. Bet local. Matt Marchese back to his full-time gig. Full-time, sort of, I believe. I think you're taking one day off this week.
I am.
Welcome back, pal.
Thanks, man. It's good to be back. And I will be taking Friday, just so everybody knows. So relax, but I'll be back next week. Don't worry about it. There'll be plenty. You'll be sick of me by the time next week is done. All right, let's look tonight. There's only two, so this one was kind of. I mean, both games are pretty good, but this one's. I really like this one. It's the Kings at the Canucks. The puck line is Canucks -1.5. The under has hit in 5 of the last 6 between these two in Vancouver, and 9 of the last 10 overall between these two. Vancouver is 7-2 straight up in their last 9, and LA is 4-1 straight up in their last 5.
You know, in the first hour, Elliot Friedman stopped by Maddie and talked about, you know, the structure with Rick Tocchet, and a lot of Vancouver Canucks players have talked about, you know, it's a weird thing. The more structure you bring into a game, and in some ways for some players, the more freedom you can have to play within those frames to the painting. Nils Höglander, clearly one of those players. Connor Garland, another one of those players. That line is tops right now for the Vancouver Canucks. Höglander with a pair. Saturday in the Canucks 4-2 victory over the Calgary Flames. We will stand by to see about Elias Lindholm, probably closer to game time. We'll get a better sense of whether he's going to be in or he's going to be out. Speaking of which, Ian Cole, I wouldn't be surprised if he's back in there tonight for the Vancouver Canucks. Was practicing yesterday with Carson Soucy, so don't be surprised there. The Los Angeles Kings have won 3 games in a row. Most recently, kind of a thriller against Tampa on Saturday. Hey, Maddie, 4-3 in overtime against the Bolts. Vladislav Gavrikov, the OT hero there, as we all expected. And here's one to keep in your hip pocket. With Victor Arvidsson in the lineup, the Los Angeles Kings are 6-0.
Not bad.
So maybe the key is just to bubble wrap Victor Arvidsson or nerf the world around him. Keep him healthy. That was Line Change, presented by Sports Interaction, your homegrown sportsbook. Bet local. Don't forget, tonight, as Maddie mentions, it is Rogers Monday Night Hockey, the Vancouver Canucks and the Los Angeles Kings. Shane Malloy on what could turn out to be one of the biggest decisions made in hockey. What is happening with NCAA and CHL? Get that story next. Hour 2 is on the horizon.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkin Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Welcome to hour 2 of the show. So here's the question I want you to consider, because we're going to consider this at length with my next guest. What happens if NCAA hockey changes its rules to allow CHL players in. Because it wouldn't just be a simple case of, well, now CHL players can play in NCAA hockey now, and isn't that wonderful? And look at how much more competitive NCAA hockey is. The effects of that decision will be felt by, no hyperbole here, every single high-end or otherwise hockey league potentially in the world, certainly in North America. Here to talk about this conversation, because right now it is a conversation. Nothing is concrete. Although if you read the tea leaves, you can see which way this is headed. And I don't think it has as much to do about what the coaches want as much as it has to do with what the lawyers want. Here to make sense of this one and to guide us through it is someone who's been on the story from day one. He is Shane Malloy. He is also the author of The Art of Scouting. If you're watching on 360, I'm holding up this book, which I recommend to all hockey fans right now. He is also the host of Hockey Prospect Radio on NHL Network Radio. Shane Malloy, how are you today?
Doing very well, sir. Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
The pleasure is all mine. I do want to ask you, by the way, if we have some time today, I want to park a couple of questions that I've always wanted to ask you about your book, The Art of Scouting. But before we get there, I want to be very deliberate and I suppose delicate, because it is a really sensitive conversation that offends a lot of people, that infuriates other people, that excites some people, that concerns some people. First of all, when did you first start hearing about the idea of the NCAA laxing their rules to allow CHLers in?
Well, the conversation's been off and on for probably over a decade, but it never really got serious in any respect. It was just smatterings of conversations. And I think finally in the fall, it started to pick up some steam, and I had some conversations as well with Mike McMahon from the College Hockey News about it, from what he was hearing from his side. And it started, concerns started to happen, mostly because of the ramifications of name, image, and likeness opened up a Pandora's box. And then what came out of it has been a bit of a wild west in NCAA in terms of what the athletes have in terms of their power and what they're owed financially, and then what responsibilities does the NCAA and the universities have, and the repercussions upon mostly football and basketball. Hockey is, you know, hasn't quite delved into that realm with any level of, I guess, financial seriousness as the other two. But because of that and the lawsuits that have transpired because of that, and then the NCAA, in all honesty, you look at their track record, they haven't won those, and they've capitulated to the point where now they have to make other decisions. So this came up in a conversation in the fall, and it started to pick up some steam at the World Juniors when I was there, and a little bit after that. And what I find really interesting is, and you're right, your initial comments are correct, this is a tapestry, and when you pull one string, it's going to unravel. It's going to affect, and not necessarily in a negative way, can be positive and negative, of the different leagues as are all interconnected. This is a hockey industry. It's not these little fiefdoms anymore. And I think it gives us an opportunity to reframe what the industry is. The industry is a business. We're in the entertainment industry. Regardless if you're in junior hockey or it's college hockey through pro to the NHL, it's a business problem that we're presented with. Now, how do we frame that? Do we frame it in a positive way of, this is a great opportunity? From my perspective, this is one of the best opportunities that the hockey industry potentially could come upon in over a decade. It's how do you collectively get all these voices into the same room and find common ground? Mm-hmm. And the reason why I have positivity is the changes in leadership that have transpired over the last couple of years with the USHL. Dan McKenzie came into the CHL in 2019. Glenn Heffernan's a new commissioner of the USHL. They have a new commissioner in the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League. Dan Neer, who you had on your show, is a new commissioner in the Western Hockey League, as well as the continued work by Kevin Westgarth, who I think a lot of people may not know what he does. He's the VP of Hockey Development and Strategic Coordination at the NHL, who has full support from Gary Bettman and Bill Daly as well about – collectively getting the voices in the room. And what people may not know is many of the commissioners were in Florida during the meetings, the NHL meetings, and they got a chance to sit in a room and talk to each other a little bit about how would this potentially just conversations. What do you think? What do you think? And for me, it's about once you get those principles in a room and you start talking about common ground and building a foundation of if we work at this collectively, we can solve all these problems. And I use women's hockey as a great example of this. I was really impressed is once they came together collectively, look what happened to that league. Look how an explosion of excitement that's happened with women's hockey. I think women's hockey is a perfect example of what this industry below the NHL can be if you collectively work together and that all boats rise with the tide, if you can start to solve some of your financial implications and how this is going to affect the finances of the CHL teams, the USHL teams, and what the impact of college hockey is going to be. Then as it pushes into the NHL and that CHL-NHL agreement, which will have to be completely rewritten.
Yeah, I want to go through with you. We'll do this in a second, Shane. I want to go through every single entity here, whether it's NCAA, CHL, U Sports, which I think we should throw into this equation too. I think we should throw Junior A into this as well. USHL, all the NHL certainly. Everyone who has a sort of touch point in this conversation, and I'm sure, like as I mentioned before you came on, I'm sure there will be more with the law of unintended consequences and unexpected beneficiaries and et cetera. But before we get there, is it safe to say that with all of these entities coming together, even just for a casual conversation, or even something as simple as Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly having conversations with the general managers and updating them on what the relationship is now or the conversation is between the NCAA and CHL. As much as we want to think that the NHL may want to lead or college hockey may want to lead or, you know, 14 powerful coaches may want to lead, aren't the leaders in this one the lawyers? I mean, you mentioned already name, image, likeness and what that's led to. And you're right. It's been an incredible losing streak for the NCAA in court. Like, it is spectacular. And I can't help, Shane, hearing you talk and saying to myself, this is interesting what Shane is saying here and reading in between the lines. This is hockey trying to get out in front of something before it needs to be tested in court, where the NCAA has lost at times quite spectacularly.
Now, that's a very good point that you bring up about its track record. And the NCAA, as much as like I admire some of the things they do, they're not exactly the most proactive entity in the world. Mm-hmm. And they generally are not looking to do anything proactive as of yet. However, once you have entities like, you know, I think Junior Hockey in Canada certainly has to be involved along with Hockey Canada, and USA Hockey has to be involved along with the USHL and the CHL entities. And then the NHL as well, because we're all interconnected along with college hockey. I think it'd behoove all the entities to be within the same room. And let's talk about what are the potential impacts on a positive and negative standpoint, and can we find potentially common ground? And we've seen this happen with hockey in the past. You know, Brendan Shanahan brought the group together and they started talking about common ground. And I think hockey's at its best when we're proactive and we don't wait until a storm is brewing, because we just don't want to be in put ourselves in that position. And I think there's an opportunity there. I've never been more pleased in terms of the conversations I've had behind the scenes with the different commissioners, different agents, different principals in terms of general managers saying, no, I think this could work out well for everybody. I have concerns, but I'm positive. Mm-hmm. And I think it really comes down to the new leadership. I'm not saying that the old leadership wasn't good, because they were, but it's a different animal right now. We have moved into a more global economy. And I think hockey is much more of a massive industry that we have to treat like a business and not like what we did back in the 70s and 80s and early 90s.
Certainly. With Shane Malloy, the host of Hockey Prospect Radio on NHL Network Radio, talking about the conversation revolving around allowing CHL players to play NCAA, therefore, and thereby, Shane, completely changing the hockey development model forever. And I want to get there in a second. But first, let me go through some of the various touch points here and leagues and stakeholders, etc., and just get, if you could sort of let us know what their issues are or what we should be aware of when we're having this conversation, because you're right, this touches so many different areas of hockey. It's really wide spanning here. So we'll start with the NCAA, because this is the big one. And we frame this all certainly under the umbrella of more athlete empowerment now than ever with NIL. But from the NCAA's perspective, what are the overriding issues with this happening?
I think the overriding issue that I've been told is just a flood of older players coming into the league and pushing out opportunity for the 18-year-olds that come out of high school. That certainly is one that is a concern of theirs. And then also there's the discussion of protecting American-born players in that respect. Because it is, you know, NCAA is an American entity. And, you know, there's members of Congress who have concerns about that as well. So that has to be, you know, all of a sudden there's a flood of Canadian kids coming in and taking, you know, opportunities away from American players. So I think that is a considerable issue. The other one is they want to avoid a lawsuit. When, and like, if a collective group of players get together and say the NCAA has, you know, restricted my opportunity to go play in college hockey because you deem CHL players professional, and this player said, I've never signed a contract, how do they get around that? That opens up a can of worms, and that number could run into the millions very, very quickly.
Okay, from the CHL's point of view, the Canadian Hockey League, that is the umbrella organization overseeing the QMJHL, the OHL, and the Western Hockey League. Issues here would include what?
I think the biggest issue is protecting the number of 19-year-olds that stay within the Canadian Hockey League. Their league's best players are generally their 19-year-olds. So how do you keep them in the CHL but not restrict their ability to go play in college hockey? Like, how do you come to an agreement with a player who wants to play in the CHL first or in its entirety, but not restrict their ability to go play college hockey in the States? That is going to be their biggest bugaboo, from my perspective, is how do you balance that? And I've had conversations with Dan McKenzie about that, and they don't currently have a solution, but, you know, it's certainly, he brought up a couple points that I thought were really interesting, but I'm not sure how that would work out legally. And once again, you're correct. It's going to come down to the lawyers on either side of how do we not take away the rights of the players, but then how do we protect our own business entities? And that's the delicate balance that everybody's going to walk.
Yeah, I want to get to the lawyers versus the coaches here in a couple of seconds, but I'm curious, picking your brain about, you know, if this does indeed happen, what's the future of the USHL, and is there a chance that perhaps the USHL becomes part of the CHL, as has been proposed before by people like Pat LaFontaine in the past?
Well, in the conversations I've had with members of the USHL, they're in a position where they're just going to wait and see. And if this is something that transpires and comes into fruition, then they're open to those having those conversations. And I think it really comes down to their leadership group with Glenn Heffernan as well as Ian Gentile in their head office. And will there be an impact? Yes, I mean, certainly there's going to be players that are going to shift potentially back and forth between, you know, CHL teams to USHL teams. Would you be able to trade between those leagues? Would the USHL be interested in being a part of the CHL? Would they be interested in playing for the Memorial Cup? So then you would have a host. You wouldn't have a host team anymore. You'd have a host location. I think all those things would be certainly on the table, and they would be interested in those things. Mm-hmm. However, we're just sort of putting, you know, the cart before the horse in that respect. But they are certainly have had those conversations, and they're, you know, they're certainly prepared, and they have open arms they're willing to have these conversations with the other leagues. And I know they've already started to have those conversations at a very basic level. So I think they would be open to it. And how would it affect them negatively? I think it'd be more of, do they lose players to the CHL, and does it become a competitive thing? No different than the CHL teams have with each other. But I think they're open to the possibility of this happening. And looking at it from a positive perspective, I found the USHL in my conversations very positive about this potentially happening.
You know, one of the leagues that I do specifically wonder about here is the BCHL, the British Columbia Hockey League, who have moved away from Hockey Canada and, you know, picking off, you know, players from all across the country here, essentially creating this this elite level hothouse league that allows players to go right into college from their league. Does this, for lack of a better term, does this kill the new BCHL?
I don't think it necessarily kills it, but the players that were going to go on to play college hockey and want to keep their eligibility can just go play in the CHL. So it's just a different tier of player that's going to fulfill those junior A leagues across all of Canada. I think the majority of them will end up filling up what I would call Division III in college hockey. They will end up probably filling mostly those rosters, and the kids that want to go play Div 1 or have the skill and ability to play Div 1 will just go play in the CHL or the USHL. But one of the things we gloss over is kids still have to be academically eligible. Just because you're good enough doesn't mean that you can get into the university. Like, sometimes we forget that a player's grades actually matter, and they do matter. And that's going to be a huge factor. Not every CHL player is going to be eligible. So kids, if you're listening out there, get your grades up, because it's going to be important.
Absolutely. Okay, maybe the biggest here, and they very much want a seat at the table because they're the NHL. If you're Gary Bettman, you're Bill Daly, as you mentioned, Kevin Westgarth as well. How are you feeling about this?
I think it's a positive business development, because anytime you can get entities together to pull in the same direction and then have the same vision. What's their vision? How often have we had junior leagues across North America and college hockey with the same vision? It's almost never happened. So is this an opportunity to collectively bring these brands together to be able to increase revenue across North America for junior hockey and college hockey? So look at it as a business problem. How can we increase brand awareness? How can we drive revenue? And then at the end, most importantly, yes, you're developing players, but we're developing people. So can we increase the amount of programs that we have to help these young men? And in cases, as we talk about college hockey for women, these young women, how do we develop them into being better people, better leaders? So then when they're finished playing hockey, they go into the communities and they provide the support for the next generation, not only in hockey, but in the communities overall. So it's a much greater, bigger strategic vision that I think we have to look at, not just simply the CHL players being eligible to play in college hockey. It opens up, you pull on that thread, Jeff, and it opens a tapestry. Yeah. And it's going to be interesting to see how things sort of play out.
Yeah, let me add one more string to pull here, and that is the American Hockey League. Now, at first blush or first thought, you would say, okay, well, what this does to the American Hockey League is, quite simply, keeps younger players out of the league as their development model continues, but at the collegiate level. Is there anything other than that that we should be aware of, or is that the main issue from the American Hockey League's point of view?
I think the American Hockey League wants players that are going to be capable to play in the American Hockey League. It makes it easier for the coaches and the NHL player development to develop those players. And not in every case, but I would say in the majority of cases, most players that are 20 years old have a hard time in the American Hockey League. You've seen it, I've seen it, where it's a bit of a it's a bit of an avalanche. It's like a deer caught in headlights. So if we can keep them out of that professional league a little bit later, that 1 year, that extra 2 years that players need, that's better. But what does it do? It makes the product better. If the players are able to play at a pro level and are ready, great. At the NHL level and the American Hockey League level, I like to push the development path a little bit longer and a little bit farther down the road, just on my experiences, you know, over the last 25 years of watching prospects and watching these leagues develop. I think sometimes we're a little bit impatient as an industry as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Always looking for the shiny new toy. That's true. That's true of any industry. That's true of any walk of life. Hockey should be no different. And so I do understand it. So here's what I want to get to as well. And I think this is a really interesting dynamic. And that is, and we may see this, you know, these conversations, I would suspect, would be had in early May in Naples at the American Hockey Coaches Association conference. What do you expect to happen there? I mean, there's going to be some heavy hitters, obviously, from some of the heavy hitting D1 schools, and the NCAA will be there, I would suspect, with their legal team to remind them of the legal ramifications of what could happen here if things don't change and everything stays the same. How do you see that dynamic playing itself out at the upcoming coaches conference in Naples? And what's the nature of the conversation around there? And how much is there a split between, you know, the elite programs that we're all familiar with and the other programs that would like maybe a little more of a level playing field here?
Well, I think first and foremost, as individuals, I don't think you and I are any different. We look at our own individual situation. How does it affect me and my program? So that's going to be one of the first and foremost. And then you have to look at it from a macro standpoint of, okay, how does this affect college hockey as a group? And I would say there's a couple conferences that would be more reluctant to bring this in, and there'll be conferences that are much more interested in bringing that. I think the CCHA and the Atlantic conferences would be much more interested to bring this in. They recruit at an older level anyway, at, you know, 20-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the average age of sophomores and players ending their sophomore year, you're looking at 21 years and 11 months. So on average, I don't think the CHL, and we crunched the numbers along with Mike McMahon, it won't make a difference. It really won't make a difference. So it's a matter of, how is this going to affect if I'm recruiting 18-year-old kids out of high school hockey, or I'm taking kids out of the program that are 18 years of age, how are they going to be able to stack up? Right. And am I going to be competitive against 22, 23, 24-year-old players, such as when you see teams like Quinnipiac win the national championship with a much older lineup? So that's going to be their primary concern. But then a big factor is, how many of the college coaches know anything about the CHL players? There's over 1,300 players in the CHL. Like, it'll be a very big challenge for them in terms of the recruiting process as well. So they're going to need assistance in that as well. So I think there's going to be some interesting conversations. And you're right, at the end of the day, it's the litigators and the lawyers going to look at, how do we avoid potential lawsuits down the road? That's the last thing we want. Yeah. Is we've been sued enough in other areas. We don't need hockey to join the fray and for us to face another potential lawsuit.
Yeah, and I'm glad you got us there, Shane, because that was the next, you know, sort of area that I wanted to talk about here, and that is how much, like, these are some, like, Division I coaches, like, they swing a big stick, especially with, you know, the top programs. How much does their opinion, for lack of a better term, how much does their opinion matter in all of this? You know, when Elliot and I, and you've talked about this plenty, you and Mike, you know, one of the initial pushbacks that we've gotten whenever we've talked about it is, oh, college coaches will never go for it. But then I keep coming back to this and saying, well, it's not really their decision. Like, their input will be listened to, but at the end of it, it's the lawyers that are driving this one. How much do the coaches, like, you look at this, you know, conference coming up in early May in Naples, and, you know, all the coaches are going to weigh in and share their thoughts on it. How much does their opinion, for lack of a better term, matter in this decision?
I think it certainly does matter. In terms of understanding the effects of the players and the student athletes, I think that part of their opinion, I think that carries weight. How will that affect those players? And then who's going to miss out on opportunities? So they're going to, I think that is the most significant salient point that they're going to bring to the table. But at the end of the day, coaches are competitive and they want their programs to win. So if I can recruit a player out of the CHL, that's going to help me win. You know, once the competitive juices start to flow, it'll just Some of the programs that have traditionally gone a certain way in terms of recruitment will simply just have to change their strategy. It's adapt or die. And I'm not saying all the CHL players are going to be better than the players that they're recruiting out of other programs like high school or, you know, the U.S. National Development Program, but it certainly is going to level some of the playing field in that respect. But we'll see how many of those players the CHL would be actually interested or eligible for that matter. So eligibility, like we talked about before, is still an issue. But you know what coaches are like. I don't think it matters what level they play at. They like to win, and they want to beat the other rivals. So when push comes to shove, I'm not sure whether they'll really stand their ground that hard.
Okay, we'll park that conversation, albeit briefly, bracket that. We're going to return to it at some point, we suspect sooner than later. But in the couple of moments I still have with you, Shane, I'm with Shane Malloy from Hockey Prospect Radio and NHL Network Radio, also the author of The Art of Scouting. This goes back some years. I've recommended this one to plenty of people. And one of the chapters here that I just wanted to expand on a little bit more, because, listen, you've heard this show before. We've had conversations about this. I love talking about scouts and scouting mentors. These are some of my favorite people in the industry. Love them. And there's one part of your book that I've always wanted to talk to you about expanding, and that is influential scouts. You know, there's no corner of the Hockey Hall of Fame for scouts. There probably should be. But when you look at the history of scouting at the NHL level, whether it's Jim Gregory, and the GM Award is named after him, and rightfully so, to Jack Bowman, to Jack Davidson, to Cliff Fletcher, to Doug Robinson, to Bob Owen, to Billy Taylor, to Jimmy Walker, to Barry Trapp. Who are some of the more, like, if you were going to make a Hockey Hall of Fame for scouts, who would go in, according to you, Shane Malloy?
Oh, are you putting me in the crosshairs? I'm going to get calls after this. So
We don't have enough time for you to run out the clock either.
No, right off the top of my head, you have to look at guys like Marshall Johnson and Rick Dudley. Guys like that, certainly Vaughn Carpen, I would certainly put in there. Les Jackson, Ross Mahoney, as well. Joe McDonnell, he certainly, you know, based on what they've done.
Still,
there's a laundry list of guys. I certainly would put in consideration of guys like Mike Foote and Mark Iannetti out of L.A. They've done a fantastic job recently. Martin Madden. But then you get into the older guys. Mm-hmm. You get into the Dell Wilsons of the world, Glenn Dirks and Patty Janelle. So it's tough. I could probably give you 200 names if I went through the list. And you know that I'm also a board member of the Western Canadian Professional Scouts Foundation. And so along with you, like, the scouts are my people. There are certain people in the industry like, oh, coaches are people, or the GMs, that's their guys. But me, I'm the scouts. Yeah. So I'm a little bit biased when it comes to the scouts. And I agree with you. And I think one day they deserve to have a section in the hall all to themselves.
So much of the industry is built on the work that they do, and the icy roads they travel down, and the bad coffee they drink, and the Zamboni fumes they smell every time they walk into rinks all over North America, to say nothing of Europe as well. Quick final question for you, and again, this one is about scouting. How has it changed, and where is it now? Like, even if you go back 5 years, 10 years, even like 20 years ago, how different is scouting now, or is it still, here's your schedule, here's your hotel rooms, here's your games, here's your per diem, go?
I think some of that certainly has remained the same, because that's the bedrock. But I think what has changed and evolved is scouts are starting to consider and implement different information and different data, whether it's quantitative or qualitative. So it could be analytics or statistics, or it could be more biometric information, could be more psychological information. All of that is starting to become more integrated into their decision-making process. And I think that's part of the evolution of evaluating players and looking at it from a holistic standpoint of not just short-term, but how does this all play out? And then integrating your human performance department into that. So they're starting to evolve into more of an R&D department, like a Fortune 500 company. I think that is the next evolutionary step for scouting departments, is don't look at it. Look at it from an operational standpoint of a Fortune 500 company where you have different entities. So you're, what you're searching for is cognitive diversity within your group, people with different ideas and different backgrounds in terms of their expertise or their educational background, because you have a lot of different types of data points that come in. And the scouts that are the most open-minded about that and are, have the gross mindset are the ones that will evolve along with it.
Listen, you just spent a lot of time with me, probably more than you bargained for when you woke up this morning. Thanks for parking a lot of time today, Shane. This has been really eye-opening, I think, for a lot of people, certainly for me. And this is not the last conversation we'll have of it. And if this goes through, as many of us suspect that it will, the ramifications will be staggering. We know you're on the case on Hockey Prospect Radio, on NHL Network Radio. We will be tuned in. And thanks for sharing expertise on scouting as well. That's, as you know, one of my favorite topics. Shane, thanks so much, Shane. You be well. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you, Jeff. Have a great day.
There he is, Shane Malloy from Hockey Prospect Radio, also the author of The Art of Scouting, How the Hockey Experts Really Watch the Game and Decide Who Makes It. You know, I can remember asking Brian Burke this one in one of the many nights that we've, you know, worked together, how he evaluates players. Usually this is done, I think this was the conversation we had in Buffalo at the Combine. We were out for dinner and I asked Brian sort of, you know, when he was managing, whether it was, you know, the Hartford Whalers or the Anaheim Ducks or the Maple Leafs Flames, etc. You know, how did he do it? What was his, you know, philosophy for when he went to watch players? Because when Berkey was running the Toronto Maple Leafs, every time I'd go to an Oshawa Generals game in the OHL, there was Berkey. He was always, always there. And I'm curious, I said to him once, like, what do you do when you see someone that you like? And he said, this is the philosophy that I have. And this is the philosophy that I've always stuck with. It has, you know, it's tweaked over the years, but basically this is it. He said, the first thing I do is I identify with my eyes. It's like, that's what I see based on, you know, the box of information that I've grown up with and that I live in right now. I identify with my eyes. And then I check with my staff, the analytics and the underlying numbers to make sure that those eyes that I identify with aren't lying to me. And then after that, I meet the family. He said those are the three key principles that he follows. Identify with the eye, check to make sure your eyes aren't lying, and then meet the family. And I always think about that when I hear people like Shane Malloy talking about scouts and their process and what they do. And I know I've way oversimplified it, and even Brian oversimplified it when he told me. But that is, anyway, his basis for how he identifies and measures and values prospects and players. Okay, we'll park that conversation, hit a break. Matt Marchese on the other side. Have a look back at the weekend that was. A couple of new players hitting the 50-goal mark. Congratulations. To Zach Hyman, congratulations to Sam Reinhart. And also, we should talk about the Vegas Golden Knights, a huge game tonight without Aiden Hill. We should mention as well, another key injury for the Vegas Golden Knights. This game tonight between Vegas and St. Louis is massive, and there is a clinching scenario. We'll go over that again with Matt Marchese in a moment. Merrick Show continues across the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet 360, and wherever you get your podcasts. Back in a moment.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Busy weekend around the NHL. It seems as if the Washington Capitals and Detroit Red Wings are quite content to flip-flop for that final wildcard spot in the Eastern Conference. And we'll see what happens tonight between St. Louis and the Vegas Golden Knights. Vegas could pull away, or with a regulation win, all of a sudden, I'm saying, the St. Louis Blues, could they make things real interesting? Sure. With a win tonight, despite the fact that Vegas may have a game in hand, all of a sudden, the gap is 2 points between Vegas and St. Louis for that final wild card spot. Matty Marchese is aboard. How are you doing today, Matty?
I'm good, buddy. You're right, though. The races, hey, man. The division racers are the only ones, not the only ones, but like they're the ones that have the intrigue. But the wild card race is just there's not enough teams left in it still. I was hoping, you know, a little bit closer to we'd have more teams involved, but any race is a good race this time of year.
I suppose maybe even we just, you know, drill down on the president's trophy race where seven teams are separated by 1 point.
And nobody wants
top spot in the NHL. I don't know about that. I mean, I don't see like anyone sort of pulling up. I mean, I do know the history we all do with the president's trophy and what that means for, you know, your Stanley Cup opportunities or, you know, your Stanley Cup jinxes, I suppose. But nonetheless, I still think like, I know the Stanley Cup is the Stanley Cup and the play is ratcheted up and everyone plays, you know, high octane hockey and all the hits are for keeps and no one mails it in and every inch of the ice and blah, 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 blah. I still think there's something really important about being top dog after 82 games. Like that is such a grind. Like that really does separate teams in some ways more so than the Stanley Cup separates teams. Know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess the timing too. It's like you have to maintain a pace over 82 games. Like that's an accomplishment for sure. Now I don't know this. This is my puny little brain at work here asking this question. Is there a financial windfall for finishing? For, like, do you get? Is there financial incentive to finish first?
There is. If I hang on.
So the owner likes it. The players just don't want to touch the. It's like, I don't know if I want that distinction.
Hang on. How much is it?
$20. You get it. It's in the penalty box after the game is done.
Okay. So here's how it works. President's Trophy winner, $500,000.
Pocket change. These owners can find that in their couch. Who needs 500 grand?
Oh, sure.
We got new hot dog throw machines in the arena.
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
I want to get to Hyman and Reinhardt in a couple of seconds here, but I don't know how much of the conversation with Shane Malloy you listened to at all, but the idea, you know, of the CHLers being allowed into NCAA hockey. First of all, the development model, if this goes through at some point, and we'll see where this ends up. Again, I still believe that this is a decision made by lawyers, not coaches. You know, the development model completely changes and firmly plants, you know, NCAA hockey on top of the development pyramid. You know, I would imagine CHL operators would look at this and say, ooh, that's less education packages that I have to play. Yes, sign me up for that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a thought on that conversation? I don't know how much brain time you've parked on that dynamic or that potential somewhere down the road, but do you have a thought on, you know, the idea of CHLers and NCAA and what that means for the rest of the hockey universe?
Yeah, it's a very intricate conversation too, which I definitely learned a lot more in listening to you and Shane talk about it. My first thought was this can't be a bad thing. Like I don't think it's a bad thing for the development of players overall. I think that part is very good.
Yes.
How it affects the leagues is a totally different conversation. The one thing, and I want to say it was from your, and I'm going to plug your blog here, from your Rink Fries blog. What was it? Pass the Salt and the Malt. That's what it was, Jeff.
You like that one?
Yeah, it was
Pass
good.
The salt and Malt. That's what I have on the fries.
So keeping players at their own kind of age bracket was the part of the conversation where I went, that's where I don't know if it is in the best interest all the time for the player. Like sometimes it is better to play against men when you are trying to make it to the NHL. So that was a part where I kind of went, okay, like, and how long does it, you know, does the player stay in the development model? Like that was the biggest question that I had from a player development perspective. How it affects these other leagues is going to be so interesting, I think.
Well, that'll be interesting too, because it almost feels as if, again, I'm getting way ahead of myself here, but if this goes through eventually, I do wonder about what happens with, you know, not major junior hockey in Canada, because that is obvious. It becomes, you know, you have another tier in your development.
Yeah.
You can, you know, get into playing college hockey, but the junior A level, I wonder if that just becomes essentially, here we go, Maddie, for lack of a better term, a feeder league for D3. Do the junior A loop teams all of a sudden just become feeder teams for Division III hockey in the States? I don't know, but I would suspect as much.
You're kind of there in a sense, but also it becomes a more of a feeder system for U Sports as well. Like, that's the other thing that you mentioned in your blog. Like, what happens to youth sports?
That's
a huge thing.
Yeah. They get knocked.
Yeah.
There's no way around it. There's no way around it. Like, yeah, right now, like, hockey, I mean, we've just been gushing the last few weeks about, you know, UNB on the men's side and this spectacular season where they didn't lose a game and didn't allow a goal in the final weekend and won the national championship, and Gardner McDougall, and you should make a Hall of Fame case for him. And I believe that, and rightfully so. But I think that the level of athlete in hockey at U Sports, if they go this route, will decline. It has to. If you can extend your career in NCAA, then yeah, I would imagine it would decline. That's one of the leagues I would look at, or one of the areas I would look at and say, if I'm U Sports, I'm a little bit concerned about this new proposed development model, or not even proposed, this new discussed development model. How about that?
Yeah, I honestly, like, I came up in this system where you could not even, like, if you wanted to be eligible for a scholarship, you couldn't spend, I think it was more than 48 hours at a major junior camp. Like, there was all of those things. To be honest, if you had told me that this was going to happen, you know, the light years ago that I played competitively, I would have said that's never going to happen. Yeah. Even though it didn't make much sense in my brain as to why. Now with the, you know, with the NIL money that's involved in college sports, like, you're at a point now where everybody's getting money. Like, there's no professional amateur anymore. It's everybody's kind of in the same boat.
Yeah, and that's opened the door for all of this. And I think, like, again, like, the staggering amount of losses legally that the NCAA has had to endure. I mean, I'm just glad that hockey, it sounds like they're getting out in front of it before their next one's to lose a court challenge. Because normally, you know, historically, hockey has been sort of, you know, dragged kicking and screaming into progress.
Yeah.
Like, that's the history of the sport, folks. Anyway, that conversation will continue. In the meantime, Zach Hyman, Sam Reinhart, two different paths to get to 50 goals.
Yeah.
Sam Reinhart was a second overall draft pick going back to the Aaron Ekblad draft in Philadelphia, and was selected by Tim Murray in one of the best selections I've ever heard at the draft, when Tim Murray just went up there and said, the Buffalo Sabres select Sam Reinhart. And I remember talking to him at the top prospects game afterwards and saying, like, Tim, like, that was brilliant. There was no, like, thanking everybody at some restaurant back home and congratulating the Stanley Cup champions on behalf of our team and our ownership and blah, 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 flowery language. He just went up there and made the pick. And I remember Murray said to me, yeah, well, what I want to do next year, they won't let me do. And I said, what's that? And he said, I just want to go up on stage. Maddie, think about this for a second. Tim Murray told me in Niagara at the top prospects game, said, I just want to go up on stage, not say anything, just point to who I want, and then walk off the stage. Can you? He said, but they're making me say the name, and the Buffalo Sabres are proud to select. But can you imagine a manager walking up there and just pointing? Like, you're doing sticks in the middle, right? Yeah. And you're just pointing at who you want? That would have been glorious.
Yeah, you in anyway, the blue suit way of, in this the is front a little, row.
Yeah, you. This is a long-winded way of saying I miss Tim Murray in the NHL.
Yeah.
I really miss having Tim Murray in the NHL. Anyway, Sam Reinhart comes in as a second overall draft pick. Expectations were high from day one for Sam Reinhart. You can't say the same thing about Zach Hyman. He has worked hard to earn every single bit of ice that he's enjoyed. Has he played with great players? Well, yeah, Austin Matthews to Connor McDavid. Is it a factor? Yes, but he's worked hard to get there. He had a coach like Mike Babcock who believed in him and helped him along the way. Just have a thought or two on both these two very distinct and different players who had different paths to the NHL and different paths to 50 goals.
Yeah, well, I think it goes, it's kind of a ridiculous saying, but there's different ways to score 50 goals because they do score them in different ways. Like, Zach Hyman is, as Sheldon Keefe put it, his nickname when he played for the Marlies was Shaq Hyman because he gets to the paint more than anybody else. And Sam Reinhart came in as more of the finesse guy, and he's really developed into a really good two-way player as well in the NHL. Like, goals aside, like, Sam Reinhart kills penalties and scores goals while he's doing that too. Like, he's just a great player all around. I think what it goes to show you is, in the right situation, your talent level can, you know, come to the forefront. Zach Hyman's skill level has vastly improved from the moment he stepped into the NHL. And that goes to the work ethic that he's brought every single step of the way. You can, you know, like comedian Jerry D, who's great on Twitter. His brother coached Zach Hyman in minor hockey, and he always said he was the hardest working kid on the team. And I know that's sometimes a way of being, like, you know, very snarky and sly, saying, like, yeah, he's a hard worker, but he lacks in other areas. Zach Hyman did lack in other areas, but he made up for it with the work ethic and putting the work in to get there.
So here's what I want to share with you about Zach Hyman. And this isn't about Zach Hyman, but it is about players that work hard when they're young. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to when you first started playing, first few years. Maybe you were one of these guys. I don't know.
Doubt it.
But there are the players that are just faster than everybody else.
Definitely not me.
That are bigger than everybody else. And they're skating with an advantage that one day will disappear.
Yep.
And the one thing that I always try to talk to parents about is, like, if your kid's a superstar when they're 9 or 10 or 11, just because of they just happen to be faster and they just happen to be bigger, just genetics, like, it just happens. But they don't have a work ethic that comes along with it, or they just don't work hard. They don't really try at it. They're just naturally gifted, and I'm just great at hockey.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually that stops because the skating catches up and the size catches up. Maddie, you've seen this before. If you don't marry that with a work ethic, those players become frustrated. Those players become angry, cranky. I just used to be able to outskate everybody and now I can't anymore. What do? I just used to be bigger than everybody and I'm not bigger than everybody anymore. What do I do? Zach Hyman is, to me, the story of the kid who wasn't the fastest, the kid who wasn't the biggest, who never dominated at any of these levels. Like, you go back and look at Hyman, like, you know, they were saying on Hockey Night, you know, he played on the same Red Wings team as Sam Carrick, and Carrick was the stud, right?
Yep.
To me, he was the guy who really worked hard at every single level. And at every single level, what did everyone say? He's got the bad boots.
Yeah, can't skate.
He's got heavy feet. Can't skate, forget about it. Sure, he's got nice hands and he works really hard. Well, sure, he looks like he's working hard. He can't skate, just like the Sutter family. Sure, we say they work hard because they're bad skaters. All bad skaters look like they're working hard because they're trying to skate. Ha, 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 ha. Hyman worked really, really hard. And you know what no one talks about anymore?
What's that?
Maddie, you know what no one talks about anymore? Zach Hyman skating.
Yeah, it's true.
Remember how that used to dominate the conversations?
100%.
When is the last time anyone said anything about Zach Hyman skating? They don't.
No.
He's fine.
Yeah.
And he's fine.
And to
me, that's his story.
Yeah, and the other thing with the hard work is that's why he gets the opportunity to play with players like Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner and Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl. Like, because those guys appreciate that type of player. The guy who is willing to do anything to get to what needs to be done, he will go through a wall for you. That's Zach Hyman. He's going to go to the dirty areas. He's going to do things that other guys aren't willing to do, and he's going to do it at a high rate, which I think is also super important. I'm very happy for him. He's been great.
I tend to look at Zach Hyman when you talk about sort of, you know, who he's played with. I kind of look at that and say he must have in a previous life, like, rescued a dozen puppies out of a burning house, or pulled like a child who had fallen through the ice out and saved that child's life. Because in this life, he's gotten to play with, at college, Dylan Larkin, with Toronto, Austin Matthews, and with the Edmonton Oilers, Connor McDavid. Not bad, Maddie.
Pretty good.
Hey, Zach Hyman, what did you do in a previous life to deserve that? Well, you got it. And congratulations to Hyman. Congratulations to Reinhardt. Thanks to everyone who took part in today's show. Shane Malloy, you heard from. Robbie Stanley as well. Elliot Friedman. Our crew, our producer and co-host, Matt Marchese. Technical operator, Lance Kennedy. And the great Jen Rolnick, who had the most difficult job making this look decent. All the mistakes were mine. Everybody else was excellent on today's show. Back in 22 hours for more of The Merrick Show across the Sportsnet Radio Network, Sportsnet 360, and wherever you get your podcasts.